It's time for The Car Doctor on AM 950 WROL. Got a car question? Call us at 617-770-3030. That's 617-770-3030. Now, here's The Car Doctor, John Paul, on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston.
And good Saturday morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston, or maybe you're listening on 100.3 FM, or, I don't know, maybe you're listening online, WROLradio.com, or maybe you went to your Amazon device or and said, listen to WROL Radio, ask Siri or Alexa to do it for you. There's all kinds of ways to listen to the program. And, of course, you can find past programs on our podcast site, which is johnapaul.podbean.com. Almost forgot where I was. And then there's also, you know, it's all on all the regular stuff, Spotify and Stitcher and all that sort of stuff, too. So you can find it everywhere. You know, when it comes to automotive education, there are lots of choices. You can go to high schools. You can go to a variety of different places to get an automotive education. I went to a regular high school, took an automotive class, and then went to a post-secondary school. That was a lifetime ago. But since then, there are a lot of choices, and one of the best choices is to go through a state school. And with us on the phone is Scott Fitzgerald. He's an instructor at Mass Bay Community College. Scott, good morning, and welcome to the Car Doctor program.
Good morning, John. How are you this morning?
I am just great. And it's, you know, when we talk about trying to get automotive education, you know, a lot of people, you know, there's all of a sudden a push right now, oh, you don't need to go to college. But college can certainly help. And the idea of getting an automotive education and maybe a post-secondary degree and an associate's degree can be a pretty good mix for a lot of people, right?
Oh, definitely. It absolutely is. It propels you along your career path so much faster. The training that you get as far as the basics, getting into the shop is far superior than just like coming off the street and just trying to, you know, trial by fire, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. And now Mass Bay's been a General Motors training center for 16 years now. People that have been around for a long time remember the General Motors training center where Fox 25 is, which is now, I guess, technically Boston 25. That used to be the old General Motors Training Center, and that's where GM Techs and some others, if you're affiliated with AC Delco, that's where you went to get training. But you guys have been doing training with General Motors with their after high school program for 16 years now, right?
Yeah, the General Motors program is called ASAP. We've been doing GM Techs, in getting them in the dealers, and then after they come back for manufacturer-specific update training yearly.
And, you know, besides General Motors, you guys also handle a lot of the major OEM manufacturer programs, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. Besides General Motors, we do Toyota. I teach the Chrysler program. We also do BMW also.
Mm. And last time I was at your facility up in Ashland, I think I saw, what was it, Hunter might have been up there. You do some in Bosch maybe or something. Was there something else going on up there too?
Yeah, we have a complete Hunter lab. And it's a partnership with Hunter that they teach some of their technicians to use their equipment. We also teach our guys how to use it. I just received my alignment certification so that I can teach Hunter-specific alignment procedures.
And, you know, when I was a young tech a billion years ago, alignments were, it was basically a thing that looked like a level that attached to a wheel. Now it's all lasers and lights and electronics.
Yeah, it's definitely changed quite a bit. I mean, obviously we do four-wheel alignments now. When you were doing them, you probably just aligned the front.
We used to back the car on the rack and do the backwards.
Yeah, we don't have to do that anymore.
One of the places I work for, there was a local, oddly enough, a local Ferrari dealership who didn't have an alignment rack, and they would send Ferraris over to be aligned, and that's how you did it. You would back the car on the rack and have to read all the numbers backwards because, of course, in was out and out was in and, so forth.
Sounds like a long process. Yeah, we don't have that with the technology today, it's so much nicer like that.
Let's talk about the typical student that goes either through the Chrysler program or the GM program. Are they out of high school or are they career change people?
A little bit of both. The majority of them, yeah, are younger students out of high school. Maybe they took a year off or so. So we'll say 20-ish, mm-hmm. Pretty much coming in. But I've had several students that are career changers. I have a female student right now who's not quite 30 yet, but she's changing careers coming into the Chrysler program. I've had a couple other students doing the same thing.
And when you go through, whether it's a GM program or a Chrysler program or BMW or Toyota Lexus, when you go through one of those programs, is there either an obligation to go to work for the manufacturer afterwards?
During the program, we have co-op, so half the time they're spent working. At that point, they're required to work in whichever manufacturer's dealership. After, it's their education. We hope that getting them into the dealers, that they can stay and enjoy working for mm-hmm. that particular manufacturer. But no, because you've paid for it, it's your education, there is no obligation immediately after.
So it's not like it's – I know there was a program, I think it may have been with – it might have been with Mercedes or something years ago at one of the schools, and there was an obligation when you were done. You went to a Mercedes dealer, and it was sort of a Mercedes dealer of their choice, so you could very well end up in Texas.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the Mercedes-Benz program, yeah, it was a year contract, but Mercedes-Benz paid for your training. Yeah. So that was the trade-off.
Oh, well, you know, I suppose that might be a somewhat reasonable thing. But, yeah, and I know from talking to being in some shops sometimes and talking to some shop techs who have some of your students there, all of a sudden they're learning a little from the students, too, because there may be some things that you guys are going over that either they haven't done or, frankly, forgot about.
Yeah. When we teach a course, we start with the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get into the dealership without having gone through a fundamentals program, yeah, there's certain things that you may not have gotten. So, like, as far as how systems work. So by giving them a good base knowledge, when you get into the diagnostic part of it, it's so much easier because you understand how the systems work.
Yeah. No, I was talking to a dealership tech, and one of your students came over and showed them how to do voltage drop. And he's like, I really haven't done that. He says, I'm kind of glad he was here. It kind of reminded me how to do it. And they were checking. I don't remember what they were checking, but they were checking for something. He's like, you know, he says he came over and he said, well, let's check the voltage drop on this circuit. And he's like, oh, okay. And the student actually taught the tech, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's good. I know all of our programs are pretty heavy into electrical because all our cars are electric, you know, everything's electric on our cars. So it's very important to understand the electrical fundamentals.
It absolutely is. And one of the reasons I wanted to have somebody on from the school is you guys are having a kind of an open house Wednesday the 14th, right?
The 14th or 20th. I think it's the 20th.
My note says the 14th.
Okay.
it says here, any prospective student interested in learning more about Mass Bay Automotive Technology can attend our upcoming information session on Wednesday, August 14th at 5 o'clock.
Okay, because there also is one on the 20th.
Oh, okay.
So the afternoon, I'm sorry.
Well, just to know what night you're going to be working, you know?
Yeah, I'll be there both days. But, yeah, the information session's great. You know, we tour the campus. Some of the instructors are there so they can talk to specific programs and see which ones they like, which ones they want to get into, some of the requirements in going through the program.
Now, does your program also offer a certificate program if somebody doesn't want the associate's degree? They just want the degree in, you know, from a manufacturer? Or is there an obligation that you go to school for 2 years and come out with an associate's degree?
The only program currently is Toyota Lexus that offers a certificate program. It takes the same amount of time to go through it. It's still a two-year program, but you just don't have to do the academic side. So you come up with a certificate, not a not an associate's
yep.
degree at the end.
Yeah.
All three other programs do run the degree program.
Yeah, it really, you know, you really have to look at these programs, and you know, I know right now every good garage is looking for help, and really, you know, if you come out of high school and you have some basic knowledge and a good, I guess, internal ability to work, you know, right now, the way the economy is, you can probably pretty easily get a job. I remember a million years ago when I got out of school, unless you had some sort of a degree, you weren't getting a job in a shop unless someone kind of took you in and started to send you to their schools. So coming out with this 2-year associate degree, like you said, it's a stepping stone. It gets you in a little bit quicker. And maybe you don't want to be a tech your entire life. Maybe you want to be a service manager, service director, GM at a dealership. Having that associate degree, or maybe working towards a bachelor's or even a master's degree in business administration or something, is going to get you through and maybe promoted a little bit quicker, right?
No, absolutely, yeah. You come through, and the good thing is you have better communication skills. So as a technician, you can communicate better with, you know, clients and service advisors. And then, yeah, if you wanted to move up, the possibilities are endless. You don't have to be a technician the whole time.
Yeah.
And with the Mass Transfer Program, a lot of the, all of our credits transfer to any Mass school. So to get a bachelor's degree would be it's a great stepping stone on that path.
Yeah. Are you finding, and I when I go to high schools, I'm on a couple of advisory boards with some of the high schools. Are you finding communication skills, or sometimes, because I'm looking right now at my producer and somebody else in the studio, they're both on their phones and not looking around.
Mm-hmm. Paying attention.
He's paying attention. He's a pretty good, I will admit, he's a pretty good multitasker. So, but are you finding that some of the basic communication skills sometimes with some of your students coming in are lacking, and going through your school and going through your program helps with that?
Oh, it absolutely does. Yeah, coming in, especially like trying to describe parts or how things work, is critical. And the students, yeah, are on the lacking side. But as they get through about, you know, halfway through their through their first year or so, you can see their confidence coming up. You can see that they can communicate much better. They write much better. It's amazing the transformation as they're going through this program.
Yeah, I can really see how that would be. And what a technician who's coming out to going to work in a dealership today, the question always is, can you make decent money? Well, can you make decent money?
Oh, absolutely, you can. Basically, you can write your own paycheck. As much as you want to make, you can work as much as you want. I have students, you know, making very good living. I know as a technician, I made an extremely good living. You know, coming out, starting at 40, 45 grand, it's not a bad, not a bad salary to start.
Yeah, and I know I was talking to a service manager at a local Toyota dealership, and he said he had a couple of people that are making 100 grand a year, and they were also kind of the scourge of the industry. They were going away from a flat rate program to try to keep their techs happy by saying, you know what, let's do some sort of guarantee program. So if things change, you're still going to make reasonable money and not have to worry about trying to hustle through the flat rate system. So I think there's some real opportunities out there right now.
Oh, there absolutely are. To touch on the flat rate system, flat rate is very motivating. But unfortunately, because we're going to, everything's becoming electric and there's a lot more diagnostics involved, flat rate is hard to generate an income on that, diagnosing
right.
cars and then fixing them. So yeah, doing that guarantee thing, which is how I ended my career in the shop, is definitely much better. You get much better quality work. You can take your time and diagnose the car properly so it's, you know, fixed right the first time.
Yeah, it really is. We're talking with Scott Fitzgerald from Mass Bay Community College, the automotive program. And if people want more information about the program or go to one of the open houses, where's the best place to go? Is it just Mass Bay Community College, or is there a separate website?
Our website, all that information is there. I believe there's a posting up there about the open house and the info nights. You can sign up for them, feel free. There's a phone number. Feel free to call us. You know, we're up for tours whenever you're ready.
Yeah, and Mass Bay, the automotive campus is located in Ashland at 250 Elliott Street. It's a great little campus, nice little area up there. And and then going to Wellesley for the college program, not so bad either.
No, not at all. To touch on that, we've actually brought a lot of our academic classes to the automotive campus.
Oh, okay.
So for the majority of the time, you will be in the Ashland campus for academics.
Oh, okay. Good to know. So if somebody's commuting kind of locally and they're in the Ashland area, a lot less driving back and forth between Ashland and Wellesley.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No. Great stuff. Hey Scott, I want to thank you for taking a little bit of time of your Saturday and join us up on here in the Car Doctor program. And good luck with the open house. And we'll talk soon.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right.
Pleasure having you.
All right. Take care. Bye bye. That was Scott Fitzgerald from Mass Bay Community College, their automotive program. And yeah, there is a future in, if you can fix cars, you can, like you said, you can pretty much write your own paycheck.
I'm trying to convince my son.
Oh, yeah?
But we'll see.
We'll see. Why don't we take a quick break? Hey, there's some new oil coming out in the market. And we're going to hear some of that, from a little bit about that, from the American Petroleum Institute. My name's John Paul. This is the Car Doctor program. We'll be back in a couple minutes. And welcome back to the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Well, I think almost everyone at some point has bought a quart of oil, and they have seen the quart of oil, and they've probably seen some markings on it. And one of the markings might be from API, and they go, I don't know what that is, but I know I need to get 5W30 oil, and well, that's all I know. But that marking does mean something. And with us on the phone is Kevin Ferrick from API, the American Petroleum Institute. Kevin, good morning and welcome to the Car Doctor program.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being there. I think a lot of people, you know, who have purchased oil, you know, kind of looked, you know, picked up a quart of oil, looked at it, maybe saw API on the bottle and said, I don't know what that is, and scratch their head and go to the cashier and pay for it. What is API?
Well, it stands for the American Petroleum Institute. We're a nonprofit trade association. As the name probably suggests, our members are large and small oil and gas companies here in the United States. One of the things we do advocate on behalf of our members for various things related to legislation and regulations, things like that. But probably the thing that our biggest responsibility is API is a standard setting organization. So we maintain currently about 700 standards for the oil and gas industry. The one that's near and dear to my heart is the effort that we do to set standards for engine oils. And I guess we've been a pretty good best kept secret. API has actually been setting engine oil standards for more than 70 years. We started in 1947 with some fairly simple standards for engine oils, and they've become, the standards have become much more complex over the years. About 35 years ago or so, API started, we introduced some trademarks that are used to identify the products, the engine oils that we license. These are oils that meet the API standards. And if you look on the bottle of oil, on bottles of oil, there may be two marks on there, one on the front label that says American Petroleum Institute certified. That's usually the mark that a lot of people see in their owner's manuals.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see something on the back. We call what we affectionately call the API donut. It's our service symbol, and that's been around. That's actually the oldest of the engine oil marks that we've maintained. The bottom line is that the oils that display the marks are oils that have proven to API that they meet our standards, and because they meet our standards, they're licensed by us, they're eligible to use those trademarks.
And are your standards a reflection of what the vehicle manufacturers need to put in their engines?
Yes. Yeah. We, as part of our standard setting process, we don't do it in a vacuum. We actually have a fairly large committee that meets regularly, and it includes engine manufacturers, so gasoline and diesel engine manufacturers. It includes oil marketing companies, kind of, you know, the ones that mm-hmm. people are most familiar with seeing. And it includes what are known as additive suppliers. These are companies that make the chemistry that goes into that engine, that oil manufacturers use to make engine oils. Because engine oil, for most people need to understand, is actually about 80% what we call base stock. Mm-hmm. So this is a product that comes out of the refineries, or it's a chemically based product like some synthetics. When you see people talk about a synthetic, some of those are maybe formed chemically. And then you have about 20% additive, and additive does a lot of things, among other things. It helps an engine oil, helps a base stock move at lower temperatures. It prevents things like oxidation in the engine, prevents corrosion, things like that. So when we set the standards, we actually work with all the organizations, the companies in the industry that need an engine oil performance level to be defined a certain way, and they work with us to do that.
Now, some people are very brand loyal when they come to buying oil. They only want to put Mobil 1 in, or they only want to put Castrol in, or they want to put something else in. And, you know, they all claim to be different. But if you're buying an oil that is the correct weight and the right, GF, whatever to go along with it, mm-hmm. is at that point is kind of oil.
Well, if oil was oil, we'd probably only have a few licensed companies and a few licensed products. We actually have licensed the API standards are global, are mm-hmm. globally recognized. So we're in about 60 countries. we have about 780 licensees in 60 countries, and we've licensed about 20,000 brands, 20,000 products.
Okay.
So I will tell you, there is more than one way to make an engine oil to meet our standard. There are a variety of base stocks that can be used. Mm-hmm. There's a variety of chemistries that can be used. They all have to meet this. They all have to meet the same performance, but there's more than one way to do it. Now, that said, I understand brand loyalty. What we always try to tell people is that the key thing you want to do when you're getting an oil change, you want to know what's recommended for your car or truck. Mm-hmm. And you want to understand that it's not just viscosity that you should be buying. You want to make sure you're getting we would tell you, make sure you get an API licensed oil and make sure it's the performance level that's recommended. So for most people today, they're driving cars and trucks in North America. Their automakers likely to recommend an oil that's carrying the API Starburst. Mm-hmm. That's probably what's sitting in their owner's manual.
Yep.
It's going to be a lighter. It's going to be something like a 020 or a 520 or a 530 oil, and it's going to meet the current standard, which is GF5, and API SN. It'll be on the SN. S stands for service for API. Mm-hmm. N is just the latest one that's currently licensed, and that's what sits in the top half of an API donut that's on the back of a label. So you just want to make sure that you have all those things when you're buying an oil. And that said, people often ask me what oil do I use, and I usually say which one's on sale. So that's kind of how I operate.
A man after my own heart.
Oh yeah, so. It's important to make sure you use the right oil. Oh, and by the way, make sure you get the right filter too.
Mm-hmm.
But you can move between them. There are I will tell you, our standards are performance based, but they're the baseline spec. There are oils that are better, some oils are better than others, but if they're licensed by us, they're going to at least provide the performance that the engine manufacturer has recommended for that engine.
Hmm. So the important part is making sure. And this came up recently with one of my listeners or readers. They went and had their oil change in their car. Their vehicle manufacturer recommended in their owner's manual, I think it was a 1030, kind of pretty conventional oil. And when they got their car back, it said on the service order, 020. And they said to me, so what do you think I should do? And I said, well, it's kind of interesting that your manufacturer, and it happened, I think it was a Toyota product, in later years actually went to a 020, but still your owner's manual still says it should be 1030. They said, so what do you think I should do? I said, well, to me, they put the wrong oil in the car. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd probably say the same thing. The engine manufacturers could sometimes they issue service bulletins to their dealers to say that you can use an oil. But I will tell you, I tend to be viscosity grade loyal. I actually drive drive an older car that needs 5W30, so that's what that's what I put in it. And I would say. The other thing that, and this is actually the important part, when that engine, when it was made, was designed to expect a 10W30. So the moving parts in there and everything, that engine's expecting it. So I would probably have said the same thing. I'm guilty of having dealerships remove an oil that I told them not to put in my car. That was probably good advice.
Yeah.
If the engine is supposed to use 1030, that's what they should be using.
Well, do you come in? Do you have like an API tattoo or something you can show them and say, "This is how dedicated I am"?
Well, I have business cards. I definitely do that. But I tend to, I will tell you one other thing. We always try to make sure people know is we always say follow owner's manual recommendations.
Right.
So. If the owner's manual says you got to change the oil every 5,000 miles, change it every 5,000.
Right.
You use the oil that's recommended. And the other thing, a lot of people today, and this especially in North America, most of us, a lot of us, don't change our own oil anymore. We let a service provider do it. We let a dealer do it.
Mm-hmm.
When people are getting the oil changed, take a few minutes to ask what oil is going to get used. Just like caller or your reader had asked about. It's important to confirm with the service provider what oil they're about to use, and that's particularly true if they're pumping it out of a bulk tank.
Right.
Now, there's bulk tanks, lots of people are doing that today. You really want to know what oil is coming out of that hose nozzle because it's this is the one thing we have to do probably regularly. Those of us that own cars and trucks. Periodically, we're going to take it in to get service because of the oil. It needs an oil change. People should take a few minutes to make sure that they're getting the right oil.
So if they hear that thunk, 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 thunk thing and they see somebody filling up a pitcher with oil that's coming out of a bulk tank, and or if they see him dragging a nozzle down from the ceiling of the shop, it's coming out of a bulk tank, and you just want to make sure it's the right bulk tank.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you want to know what brand that is.
Yeah.
Just because the sign says it's just because there's a bunch of big signs all over the shop for one brand or another, that may not mean that product coming out of that bulk tank is really that product. I actually usually make them put it in writing.
Yep.
Some states require it. About 29 states in the U.S. require that oil change locations put on their invoices and receipts what oil is being dispensed from bulk tanks. But it's not every state.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I hadn't even thought about that, but I know I've seen some. I know for a fact that I saw some bulk tank deliveries get the wrong oil, just like a gas station might get, you know, mistakenly diesel in the regular tank. All of a sudden, it's, 10:30 in the 520 tank.
Oh, yeah.
Can that happen.
We do test, you know, part of our responsibility is actually we test engine oils in the market. We buy bulk engine oils at oil change locations, and we buy packaged oils.
Mm-hmm.
We test them. Last year we did about 1,300 oil samples. I will tell you, many times the bulk oils look great. Sometimes they look like they got commingled, which means there's more than one brand in that mm-hmm. tank. And then, unfortunately, every now and then we find some that are really not good. And it is really easy to contaminate a bulk oil if the company that's delivering the product is not managing their own delivery tanks correctly.
Right.
It's pretty easy to cause a problem.
Now, years ago, some old timer once told me it was never a good idea to mix brands in the process of doing oil change. So, you know, 3 quarts of 1030, one brand, 2 quarts of 1030, another brand, because what you pointed out, the 20% additive or, you know, or 20% additional to the base stock, whether it's additives or a combination of a variety of things, might be kind of counterproductive when you mix them together. Was that just an old wives' tale, or is there some truth to that?
Well, remember, I said 20,000 licensed oils, so
right.
there oils can be different. There is a requirement today that if you have two different brands of oil, same viscosity grade, same performance level, that's important to remember. So let's say you have two oils that are API 25W20 API licensed oils that carry the Starburst.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so those oils, there's a requirement for in our standards that say they have to be homogeneous and miscible. So you should be able to mix those two licensed oils and get the performance that you expect. In other words, that mm-hmm. the oils should be able to be mixed. Now, that said, even we recommend that if you're getting an oil change, it's probably best to not mix. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using whatever brand you want to use, you're going to use Mobil 1. You're going to use a Pennzoil, a
yep.
Valvoline. You probably want to get 5 quarts of that oil when it's time to do the change. Now, where this miscibility is important is if you're driving along your 2,000, 3,000 miles into your oil change and your car needs to be topped off. At that point, if you need a quart, what we're going to
yeah.
tell you is whatever quart you can get your hands on that's, again, the right vis grade, the right performance level, it's better to get that in there. And you should be confident that it will not cause a problem in your engine.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely makes sense. And no, it's just, it's one of those things you always hear stories about. You know, in the near future, some of the vehicle manufacturers are talking about to try to get lower emissions and higher fuel economy. They're actually going to raise compression and you know, what they're looking for is actually high octane gasoline, higher than what we're seeing now, maybe octane up around 100 points rather than 93 we're seeing now. But oil is also changing, and there's a new GF6 motor oil that's coming out that maybe as we've gone into direct fuel injection, which has had its own little share of problems, there's a new new oil standard coming out for 2020. Is that correct?
That is correct. So May 1st, 2020, we'll start licensing what is GF6, GF6A and B. B is in boy, and then API SP will replace SN. I always have to point out to people that we do know what the alphabet is, but we are deliberately skipping the letter O because that would make it APISO, and SO is an ExxonMobil brand. We think very highly of ExxonMobil, but we're not gonna have a
you're not gonna have a trademark category. Dispute.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah,
that's a good way to put it. So yeah, this new standard's coming out. The last time we introduced a standard was about, well, it'll be, by the time we introduce the new one, it'll be 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, engine oils have had to change because engines have changed. So we've updated the standard. There's the new standards include 7 new engine tests. So when engine oils get tested, you pour them into engine test stands that are in cells and test labs. They both happen to be the two independent labs are both in San Antonio, Texas. Mm-hmm. So you take the oil, you put them in there, and you basically hope the oil survives the test. But these new engines are more reminiscent of the engines that are on the road today. So the intent is to make sure that oils that are being licensed are actually capable of protecting the engines that are on the road today and that are going to be introduced. In this case, what's going to be a little different is with the new standard, there's going to be GF6A is essentially the replacement for GF5. So the oils that are licensed for the API Starburst on the front labels, they're going to have to upgrade to GF6A. GF6B is being introduced separately because it's intended for very low viscosity engine oils. So you're going to see a new symbol. It looks like a shield that'll appear on 0W16 oils. I don't know if any of your listeners are driving cars where those are recommended, but 0W16, believe it or not, is on the shelf today, and it's being recommended for some cars.
Yeah, I think some Hondas and Toyotas are using it.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And then for the applications for the type of oil where the lower viscosity oils or the fuel economy oils aren't recommended, those oils will be SP. The key thing is the new standards are being brought out largely because there are things in today's engines that we have to make sure are protected. And one of them that you were kind of alluding to, gasoline direct inject engines, particularly ones that are small gasoline direct inject engines with turbocharging, have experienced a bit of a problem called low speed pre-ignition. That's essentially where there's an unexpected or an early combustion event that actually can cause damage in the engine. And they've determined that oils may contribute to that. So with the new engine oils that are coming out, particularly if you're driving a car that one of these GDI turbocharged engines, you really need to pay attention to the oil you're using. Now, there are oils on the market today that will protect those engines, but the GF6 oils that are coming out will specifically address that. They will also they'll provide better fuel economy. They're going to provide better wear protection because there's new wear tests that are being introduced. And they're going to have there's a component called a chain wear test, which is brand new for API and for API standards. And it's intended to do exactly what it sounds like. It's going to make sure that the engine oils are going to protect the timing chains in today's cars and trucks.
Yeah, no, important things. I mean, oil, let's face it, oil's the lifeblood of any engine, and it's important to make sure you use the right one. Is it just me jumping to conclusions here, but are these very thin oils, are they typically always synthetic?
Well, I've heard that. Remember, synthetic, we don't define it.
Okay.
If you can imagine trying to get a bunch of engineers to try to agree on a definition, I would tell you that it's a challenge.
Yeah.
So we don't define it, but for most people, what it really means is it just means that it's a higher grade of base stock. So there's a couple types of base stocks that usually people consider synthetic. From what we understand, the lighter oils do require, they're going to require a higher base stock. Eventually, companies, you know, they're very innovative. They may find ways to go for, what they might call a semi-synthetic, to deliver that kind of performance. But it's probably going to take some time for them to do that. But yeah, they're going to use a high-grade base stock, particularly these really low viscosity engine oils. The other thing that your listeners may want to keep in mind, the standards for these low viscosity grades are no different than the standards for, say, a 10W30 that meets the same performance standard. They all have to pass the test, which means they don't give a less of a wear requirement for a low viscosity oil. They have to meet the same performance level as a heavier oil. The other thing we always try to tell people is don't assume that a thicker oil is always better. If you have an engine where a 0.16 is, or a 0.20 or a 5.20 is recommended, again, the important thing to remember is that engine was designed to expect that viscosity.
Right.
All the timing is set on that. There's what they call valve actuation in engines that it may be dependent on a particular weight of engine oil. And then the other thing that people forget is engine oils are working to cool the engine. And some of these engines are expecting a lighter oil that's going to flow more readily to provide that cooling function.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've always been told that engine oil provides 20% to 25% of engine cooling. So you think it's the radiator and the coolant, but in fact, it's the oil. If people want more information about oil and API, is there a website they can go to learn a little bit more about some of the everything you guys do and a little bit more about oil chemistry and how it all works?
Sure, absolutely. What you want to do, I will apologize finding us on our website because, you know, we're the
trade association.
We provide a lot of service to the industry, but just go to api.org. So API stands for American Petroleum Institute, API.org, and just look for engine oil and you'll find information in there and you'll find a list of the companies that we license.
Well, perfect. Kevin, thanks for taking some time out of your Saturday morning and joining us up here in Boston.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Love your city.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye now. Well, first off, I need to apologize to our trivia winner from last week. Totally forgot to send out his trivia prize. I will do that this week, and we'll do trivia again this week, too, just because. Also, Salem Media Group is hosting a free advanced screening of a new movie coming out. It's called Overcomer. The movie is from the creators of The War Room, and it's inspired by true events about a basketball coach who gets stuck coaching a track and field team, except no one signs up. Apparently, one student. It's a great story about what happens after that. It's a feel-good movie. Bring the kids before they go back to school. Better than anything, it's free. But there's only so many seats. It's going to be Tuesday, August 20th, so in about a week and a half, I guess, at 7 p.m. at the AMC South Bay Theater. That's in Dorchester on 25 District Ave. It's an inspiring movie. If you want to find out more information about it, you can find it on our website, but if you want to go get a seat, go to WROLradio.com and you can find out more information on how to get a seat. And I think there's a trailer on WEZE's site. So if you go to WEZE Radio, you can see the trailer for it. But if you want to sign up for a seat, go to WROL Radio, hit the banner, and you can get a seat. Why don't we take a break? When we come back, we're going to do a little trivia. And our phone lines are open now at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. We'll be right back. Guess you better slow your Mustang down.
She said, baby, can't you see?
And welcome back to the Car Doctor Program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. If you would like to join us, 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. And I know Dennis has been using one too. I put a dash cam in my car the other day, and I'm trying it out. I'll give you more information about it as we're coming up. But what do you think of them?
I like it. It helps me actually drive even more safe because, well, now I don't want to be the one caught on my own camera doing something stupid.
How long does your camera record in long things, or like the one I have records in short little like 7 second vignettes?
I think mine's up to 30 seconds.
30 seconds, okay. And this one's actually pretty unique. It's the company sent it to me, and they're a Chinese company. And what's sort of interesting is the conversation we have going back and forth, because my Chinese is not very good, and either is their English, apparently. So, but it's a, it actually has a built-in GPS module, so it actually, on the video, tells you where you are based on longitude and latitude. It has some advanced driver assistance functions where it tells you if you're drifting out of the lane.
Mine has all that as well.
Yeah.
I turned all that off
all
because
that off.
It just
– Yeah.
It's, so mine has when you're getting too close. So where I'm currently staying while my house is getting remodeled, you have to go up a hill, and as you're going up a hill, there's a house with a wall. So as you're getting close to the turn, it was just beep, beep, beep.
Oh, yeah.
Car is too close to other vehicle. And it was crazy. I'm like, nope, turn that off. I turn it, and it has some. It's got this weird detection for certain video cameras.
Oh, okay.
But I know, like, because of where I drive, I know when it's about to go off. But I don't see the, what video cameras they're grabbing. I'm like, okay, I don't know what this is all about.
So it can find like traffic cameras.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
but
like
where
light
it goes,
cameras, there's none there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it's finding, but
yeah, it might, who knows. That's sort of interesting. And this one doesn't have that function, but it has a surveillance function. So when you shut it off, it shuts off and it's got a little battery, not a long battery life, but if somebody does something to the car or something sets it off, like last night at 11:30, something happened in my yard, apparently, that it was enough to record a little short clip, and it was someone's headlights. So somebody maybe, you know, turned around in my driveway or something and set it off.
So do you have? Does yours have a rear-facing camera as well?
No,
or do you
just
pull
just forward-facing.
Yeah, mine has something like that as well. I think a lot of them do.
Yeah.
So mine has a bump feature, like if someone bumps your car, it's going to turn on.
Yeah. And most importantly, they're all set up to, if you do get into a crash, it records that time frame and doesn't write over it. So you have that information, so it won't go away.
Right. Mine also has a feature where I could take a picture of, like, if a car is going, like, really crazy in front of me or something like that, I can actually take the picture of the license plate. I can push a button on it. And it'll save that segment as well for a little while. It says, like,
This one, interestingly, Wi-Fi's to my phone.
Mine does not do that.
No. But it's so, and it's actually real wide. It's not Bluetooth. It's actually Wi-Fi, which I found kind of interesting. So you can actually review, and it doesn't download to your phone. It just connects to your phone, so you can review stuff on a little bit bigger screen. And then you can decide if you want to save it to your phone afterwards and email it to somebody. So it's the technology is kind of interesting. So been playing with it a little bit. The one thing I don't like about it, other than it came with zero directions, and it needed a memory card. And I had a small memory card that I put it in, and then it did an upgrade. And as soon as it did it, it exceeded the memory of the card, so I had to get a bigger memory card.
The biggest memory card I could feasibly
get. Yeah, I just didn't have one. So
mine is the power cord. I have to string it along. I had it strung along the top of the windshield and then down the side. And the things that I was using, when it got too hot, the sticky wore off.
Yeah.
So my wife's been on me for like 2 weeks. When are you fixing this? Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I just put this in temporarily, so it's the wire goes up over the visor, kind of wraps around, and then where the rubber weather strip is on the door, I was able to peel the weather strip back, stick the wire under there, and then drop it down. And because I wasn't neat about it, I put it under the floor mat and up the other side and plugged into one of the USB ports. So
under the floor mat, that could be something I could do.
Yeah. So you don't really see it. You know, it's under the mat. Doesn't go anywhere. So, but I did it yesterday because I was driving out to Palmer Motorsports. Now, Palmer, Massachusetts, I don't even know where Palmer, Massachusetts is. It's near Sturbridge and Warren. Sturbridge, I know. Warren, I don't.
Yeah, it's not that far out.
But I didn't know where it was. And there's the woman who's the PR person from Palmer Motorsports. For a year and a half now, she's like, you got to come out and see our racetrack. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like it'd be fun. And for a year and a half, I've been saying, yeah, that sounds like it'll be fun. And I haven't done it. So Craig Fitzgerald, who is the editor at Gatehouse, who does Best Ride, who runs my column. By the way, go to one of the Gatehouse newspapers. Patriot Ledger, I think, has it. Brockton Enterprise, million different papers carry it. And go find my section, because Craig always takes my question and adds his own little sense of humor. So I was answering a question about a 1984 Chevy Celebrity or something. And he said, you know, the car doctor answers questions about, you know, how to set your VCR clock, how to attain level 256 on some video game, and harkening back to questions of the 80s. So he was making fun of me a bit, which is fine. Hey, I only answer the questions. What do I know? So he does offer that little bit of a twist to them when he does a little bit of editing to my column. But we went out and we sat through the classroom portion of the program, where they go over all of the safety programs. And Palmer Motorsports is essentially a country club for people who don't play golf. So if you have a car of some sort that you want to run on a track at essentially unlimited speed, you join this club. The initiation fee is based on how much use you want to have of the track. So it's like $7,000 one-time fee, and that gives you a certain amount of usage, or $20,000 if you want more usage. Now, you can join an expensive country club in this area, and it might cost you $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for an exclusive country club. This is sort of the same idea, and as they are able to build, they put about $15 million into this property so far. And it doesn't have a lot of infrastructure. So there's a few garage spaces now where people can store their cars. There's a small covered pit area where you can do a little bit of work. There's restrooms, a food truck, and a classroom, which is basically a trailer. But you can get out on track, and you can drive as aggressively as you want until someone decides you're being too aggressive and throws you out, if you're a danger to other people. And looking at the cars there was Corvettes and a Lotus and a Ferrari and some other cars. But there was also a Subaru WRX, and it was a guy and his daughter built the car. And this was his daughter's first run out on the track. And I was talking to the guy, and Craig also is the editor for the Subaru Performance magazine and does some for the Subaru Customer magazine. If you own a Subaru, you get a magazine. And he edits some of that stuff. And he got a great story talking to this guy and his daughter and how they put the Subaru together and how she's interested in racing it and going out on the track. And she came back and had a really good time. So you go out for typically 3 or 4 laps at a time, I think. And it's about a 3-mile long track.
Are you the only one on the track at the time?
Nope. There is specific passing areas where you are allowed to pass. the passing is usually done kind of in a point by method. So if you're not, if you see somebody in your rearview mirror that's coming up on you, you know, signal to them which side to pass on. You'll stay on the line so they go by you without anyone endangering anyone. But there are cars that can probably go 150 miles an hour on this track. I went out with a guy who owns a security company from Sharon. He had a Ford Mustang, and it was one fast Mustang. So it was, we went out on a slow trip around the track, actually in a pickup truck, just to see what the track was like. And then we went out in this guy's car. Craig and I each did about three or four laps in this guy's car. And you can get going pretty good. You can get going pretty
good.
Sounds
awesome.
And for the day, if you you know, if you want to go out and spend the day there, I think it's like $300 for however that works, and which is I think cheaper than there's a brand new indoor go-kart track amusement place in Wrentham, maybe.
Yes.
It's the biggest indoor go-kart track on the East Coast, I think.
Yeah, and an ambulance goes there at least twice a day.
I think it's like, but I think it's like $25 a lap.
Something like that, yeah.
It's really expensive. So
you can go up to Marlboro and go to Apex and go to the indoor track there, which is fun.
Or you could go right here. Or you could go to Braintree. You could go to
F1
track, which is a nice track,
it is.
Too.
It's really
nice.
Yeah.
So,
okay, free plugs are over.
Okay. All right. So anyway, so I went out there, and the other kind of in the realm of stuff I'm looking at, I think I talked about a month or so ago about a product from the company Works, WORX. They make leaf trimmers and blowers and stuff, but they've also made a couple of interesting things. One was a little cutoff tool. So a little grinder type thing, like almost like an angle grinder. So if you need to cut a piece of sheet metal or you need to cut a piece of angle iron, this is a little one that uses a little 20-volt battery. You know, use a little 3-inch wheel on it. And kind of handy for little quick things you need to cut. You don't want to either drag out an extension cord or if you're in a big shop, an air hose. And it actually works pretty well. I'm now trying out they don't call it a pressure washer. They call it a power washer. And it uses and I'll talk about this more in the next week or so. It uses two of their 20-volt batteries. So it's a 40-volt system. It has its own pump in it. So, and one of the questions somebody wrote to me last week in the Rhode Island area. They have a Jeep and they love to go off-roading. But unlike every other Jeep owner in the world, they hate driving around with mud all over their Jeep. Most Jeep owners love to drive around with mud all over their Jeep. It's like, look how aggressive I am. I got my old. This guy said, and what he does, he has a 5-gallon jug of water in a bucket, and he tries to wash all the mud off before he comes home, and probably his wife yells at him or something. But this thing is kind of nice because you don't need a regular water source. He could use his 5-gallon jug of water, put the hose in it, and it'll suck the water right out of the jug. So, and because it's a power washer, it actually uses less water per, you know, a garden hose uses X amount of gallons per minute. This actually uses less water at a higher pressure. So typical garden hose is 60 pounds of water pressure. This is 450 pounds. Pressure washer is a couple thousand pounds. So it's not going to blast dirt off like a pressure washer. But it is going to be a lot better and do a lot better job. And it also has a whole bunch of attachments you can buy for it to make it a little bit easier. So, you know, for washing patio furniture and stuff, yeah, you can hook it up to a hose, absolutely. But if you want to do more than that, you can, you're washing off your patio and you suck the water out of your hot tub. I don't know. You can do all kinds of crazy stuff with it. So, but I've been playing with that a little bit, and what's nice is it's the same 20-volt batteries that go in all of their other accessories. So this one uses two 20-volt to make 40 volts, and which, because I'm smart and I know 2 times 20 is 40.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can do math.
but what's nice is if, like, I have a work light that runs on a 20-volt battery. I can pop one of these batteries in, so I can have this kind of steady group of batteries going. So it's kind of same like I have a Ryobi drill and saw and stuff, and it all runs the same 18-volt battery, so you can switch them back and forth. So same kind of same idea. And so far, it's a pretty neat little tool. So I'll talk more about it next week.
You can talk more about it?
More okay. about it. Well, more personal experience about okay. it. And how it, and I don't have the details because I wrote something up about it, and it's in my computer.
And your computer's still updating?
And it's been updating now for an hour and a half maybe. So it's still updating.
Get a new one.
Okay. It worked fine until I went to update it. Okay, time for a little trivia. We don't have to take a break yet, do we? Nope.
No, we're good.
Okay.
We could do the trivia question and get it out there and take the break, and Keith can answer the phones.
There we go. Okay. What was the first Japanese car to be produced in the United States? What was the first Japanese car to be produced in the United States? If you know the answer to that, give us a call at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. And we will give you, I think I have another AAA membership, so we'll give you a AAA membership. So our phone number, 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. And if you won last week, if you are Bill from Medford who won last week, I apologize. I haven't set your prize out yet, but I will this week when I get back to work. So I apologize for that. Why don't we take a break? My name's John Paul. This is the Car Doctor Program. Trivia question. What was the first Japanese car to be produced in the United States? We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Car Doctor Program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Well, this trivia question might have been too easy because we have a lot of people guessing at it. And before we get to the trivia, though, this just kind of struck me as an odd headline. It says, veganism spreads from the menu to the automobile. Who wrote that headline? Veganism is now a strict diet for many people. And it often comes with a lifestyle choice that are similar animal-free in nature. For automotive content suppliers, that raises new material concerns. And so designers are now looking at using synthetic leathers on racing-style seats, trim pieces, and so forth. Years back, there was the... There was a car that, and I think maybe even the BMW i3 has a like vegan friendly interior. So it uses sustainable woods, it uses plant based stuff. Although it's kind of interesting that the vehicle manufacturers went to soy based foams in their cars, and mice eat it. It's apparently attracts mice. So instead of using petroleum-based products covering wires and seat cushions and stuff, they used soy-based, and the soy-based stuff attracts mice, and the mice eat it and chew through the wires, and people's cars don't work afterwards.
But my understanding is that the soy-based insulation stuff can be replaced a lot easier and cheaper, too. That's my understanding.
Yeah, no, well, it's kind of funny. Honda came out with a mouse wrap. So on their wiring, you can get this tape that's embedded with hot pepper flakes or something.
That works.
So yeah, to
let them bite into that thing. Woo!
Yeah. So just for that kind of reason. So what line are we going to there?
Line three.
Okay, line three. So line three. Here we go. Skippy.
Yes, sir. Dr. Paul. This is a wild guess. I don't even know. I was just hearing wild guess. Is it a DeSoto?
A DeSoto?
Well, it sounds like Japanese. Mr. Moto.
DeSoto, DeSoto. Mr. Moto?
Yeah, Fuji photo. I mean, come on. I'm going along again.
You know, that is the most creative guess we've had in a long time. But unfortunately, you're wrong. But I love the guess, though. I love the guess. And, you know, Sully's sitting here in the studio. He laughed. I thought he was going to spit out his coffee. Yeah.
What do we get, half a gift? A half a gift for creativity?
Sure. You stay right there. We'll give you half a gift. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but we'll give you half a gift. Stay right there.
Just give me the best half.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. But we'll send you out something. How's that, Skippy?
Yes, sir.
All right. Stay right there. Thank you. Don't go away. All right. Where are we going now?
We dropped him by accident. Oh. So, Skippy, if you want to call back.
All right.
We're going to go to John on line 4.
Okay. John on line 4. John?
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. You're not gonna guess DeSoto, Mr. Moto, are you?
Hopefully not.
All right.
I'm gonna guess the Accord.
The Accord would be absolutely right. In 1982, the first American-produced Honda Accord rolled off the assembly line in Marysville, Ohio, where I think they formerly built Honda Goldwings. So yep. You are absolutely
amazing
right.
Amazing how many of them are built here now.
Yeah, I think it's unusual to see an Accord that's not built here. In fact, I remember talking with an engineer from Honda who said the quality of the Hondas made here in the United States are actually slightly better than the Hondas made in Japan because the Japanese plant is older. So,
and Hyundai makes cars here now.
Toyota, Hyundai, Kia, and Ford. You know, Ford makes cars in Canada. So, you know, it's just when you think you got it all figured out, you don't. So, yeah. So it is kind of interesting how how things have changed and how manufacturers have changed. But yeah, they all come here, and it was kind of funny. John White, who used to be the old auto writer at the Boston Globe, got in a big argument with a guy from Nissan once about Nissan building cars in the United States. And John said, well, yeah, but you know, they're not really builders. They're builders, not manufacturers. And he said, no, we're a real manufacturer. We stamp steel here. And he said, yeah, but all the money goes back to Japan and it doesn't get reinvested. And, apparently the Boston Globe pension fund, was partially funded by investing in Nissan. So he's like, oh, okay, maybe the money does get kept here. So
do we still have those domestic content laws, or do they now have to tell you how much of your car is from the U.S.?
Every car you buy now on the window sticker, it will tell you what percentage of that car is made in the United States and where the rest of the content comes from. And it was sort of interesting that the last Buick that I drove, I want to say, and I'm guessing the number, but it was in the 90% range, was made in China.
Was that the Encore?
No, it was the Envision, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Might have been
the little one, little SUV?
Yeah, yeah. So it was, and it was kind of funny because a guy that I know was looking at it and says, hey, a Buick, I'm thinking about, you know, I kind of want to buy an American car. And I'm like, it's American in name only. I said, it's really 90% of it's made in China.
Yeah, I guess you have to look at the window sticker and not the name of the manufacturer.
Yep. No, because you can look at a Toyota and it might be 90% of it's made in the United States with 10% of the parts coming from, you know, Korea or something. So
bottom line is where does the money that you pay for it actually stay?
That's right.
Does it stay in the United States? Does it go overseas? Yep. But if they're made in America, some of that money's still coming back to America.
Like the argument with the guy from Nissan, you know, it partially funded the Globe's pension fund.
Yes.
Yeah, so you never know. Hey, stay right there. We will we'll put you on hold and we'll get your address down and we'll send you out a AAA membership. So there you go.
Already put him on hold.
All right. So as long as you know what to do. As long as you guys know what to do from that side. So, and it's, I got an email from our buddy Paul in Braintree, who emails me every once in a while, and he said, looks like another automobile-related scam on Facebook. Had a slow morning. I watched the video, usually Facebook-type video, long video that tells you nothing until the end. That is so true, though. There are some Facebook videos that just get to the end. And then when they have the commercial stuck in the middle that you can't get by, I find it aggravating. But it says, tells you about trying to bring old car batteries back to life with a new easy battery reconditioning method. And it says it started off at $299. By the end of the video, it goes down to $47. I'm sure this is an old but dangerous scam that you can recondition a dead car battery. He didn't buy it. So yeah, you can really, you know, the only way you can recondition there was a guy in Rhode Island who actually reconditioned dead car batteries. But what he did, he would actually cut the top off the battery, pull out the dead cell, solder in a new cell, and then fill it back up with slightly filtered electrolyte, which made it work. And that got kind of crazy because they were $20 batteries by the time they were done. And at the time, batteries were a lot cheaper. Now, batteries have gotten a lot more expensive. It's not unusual now to pay a couple $100 for a car battery. Speaking of things that run on batteries, there's a vintage electric bicycle. And the thing is really nice looking. It's a company called Vintage Electric Crafts, and it's a powerful electric bike that artfully blends vintage-inspired design and classic board track racers with the best of EV technology. Vintage Electric is proud to present the all-new 2020 Roadster model for riders looking for a high-performance electric bicycle paired with a unique cafe racer design. Designed in the grand tradition of open-air sports cars, I don't know if I could quite go that far, the new electric vintage electric bike is optimized for performance and comfort. It's a really nice looking bike until I looked at the price. And the price was shockingly expensive. I think like $6,000. In Rhode Island, like here, we are starting to see a lot of dockless bikes. You see the Lime bikes around here. In Rhode Island, they have jump bikes. Apparently, the local kids some of the Rhode Island cities have figured out how to disable the GPS systems in them, and they're ending up getting stolen. What the other interesting thing is, I saw a jump bike in my town. Well, I'm pretty sure no one rode the jump bike the 50 miles from Providence to my house. So I thought that was a little bit interesting. So. Our phone lines are open if you were trying to get through. Our phone lines are open at 617-770-3030. We only have a few minutes left, but if you still want to get through. This headline kind of made me scratch my head. It says, Dodge fans love horsepower, the sound, the smell, the fuel. Now they can love how it feels in their wallet. Dodge's latest incentive promises cash rebate worth $10 for each unit of rated horsepower on the Dodge Charger. Challenger, Durango models. Sorry, if you buy a Dodge Caravan minivan, you don't get horsepower dollars back. But it says here, Dodge Power Dollars program applies to everything from the base 292-horsepower Charger SXT to the 797-horsepower Challenger SRT Hellcat Red Eye. So you get a $7,970 rebate. So FCA's passion for muscle cars, I guess they came up with an interesting idea about a way to do it.
Wait, sorry, I have to interrupt because you had an article earlier. I saw something on one of your Facebook posts about somebody who had a 1984 something earlier this week that was having a hard time starting.
That was the story that Craig made fun of.
Yeah. Yes. I thought it was funny. My immediate thought was, yeah, it's a 1984, whatever it was. Of course it's going to have a hard time starting. I'm like, but I understand what they were using it for, which makes sense. But still, of course, you're going to have, how old is that? I can't do math right now. 25-year-old car?
It's old.
Yeah, it's going to have a hard time starting.
35.
Oh, my
goodness. Yeah, so, yes, it's an old car with starting problems. You're absolutely right. But it was actually typically a simple fix. It was really just – it was an actually complicated, weird system because this car had a starting problem. And what would happen would be you'd go out there first thing in the morning, crank, 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 crank. The thing would finally fire up and start and run fine all day. But it would take a long time to crank over and start. And what happens is the way the system works, there's a fuel pump relay that when you turn the key on, the relay comes on and turns the fuel pump on. And when fuel pump relays stop working, cars don't start. But GM did something rather unique. They bypassed the fuel pump relay with an oil pressure switch. So once the oil pressure got up to where it should be, it bypassed the fuel pump relay and powered up the fuel pump so it started up. So people just noticed long cranking and said, well, I don't know what's wrong. It starts up all the time. It just cranks over forever until it starts up. And most of the time the fix, you know, people would put fuel pumps in because they thought it was that. Most of the time the fix was a very simple fuel pump relay, which wasn't very expensive, rather than putting in a rather expensive fuel pump. If it wasn't the fuel pump relay or it wasn't a wire, it was actually the computer in the car went bad, and that's it was a driver who did actually an electrical component that caused the fuel pump relay not to work. But it was one of those things, there was a lot of fuel pumps put in by mistake.
Oops.
And that people didn't need to put in, and that was kind of the issue with them. And so I thought it was one of those. The other part of it was when I saw the question come up, I'm like, oh yeah, that's simple. It's an what is it exactly? That was 35 years ago. What? So I actually had to stop and think what that really was. Yeah. So I was like, is it the no? It's the oil pressure. No. It's a fuel. No, it's a computer, fuel pump relay. Yeah, which is pretty, you know, when people say they have starting problems, first thing, even at road service, when we do road service calls sometimes and somebody says their car cranks over and won't start, in a lot of cars today, the relays are all the same. So you take the relay out for the horn, put it in where the fuel pump relay goes, the car starts up, you hand the person the relay and say, this is what's wrong, go buy another one and have somebody put it in for you and, you know, you're on your way and you can drive away.
That's fantastic. I did not know that.
Yeah. Sometimes that's the way it goes. So other times when we have cars that won't start, sometimes the fuel pump itself, if it's an older car, and especially if it's someone who drives around on almost fumes in their gas tank all the time, like Paul Sullivan, who just hit his humerus bone. So, so it is... So what we'll do is we'll tell the person to try to crank over the engine, and we'll kind of crawl under the car with a rubber mallet and bang the bottom of the fuel tank a few times. That's enough to jar the fuel pump to work. Car will start up, and we'll go, yeah, it's going to need a fuel pump, and don't shut it off between here and wherever you go. And also, when you get the fuel pump, don't fill it up now. But when you get the fuel pump replaced, don't drive around on fumes all the time because it burns out the fuel pump. Because the fool that doesn't put the fuel in the car, without the fuel, the pump tends to run hot, and there's the problem. So, now let's see, is Paul back together now?
What's in that bag? Like, oh my God.
You hit the corner of the chair, dude. Oh, I did.
Yeah. All right. So, for those who can't see the video camera because we don't have one.
Yeah, well, we do have one, but it's not.
Yeah, the Facebook, for people who can't see the Facebook Live post because we don't do one. Paul Sullivan just hit his humerus bone on the back of a chair.
I did.
And it's smarted, apparently.
Not so funny bone.
I know. Yeah. So, yeah.
Hey, that's like using the mallet there is the equivalent of kicking the TV, isn't it?
Pretty much. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I used to do that.
But there's an old joke that I have just enough time to tell about the guy that comes out and... the person's furnace doesn't work in their house, and they come out and they go, can you fix my furnace? Guy comes out, looks at it, scratches his head, whacks the side of the furnace with a hammer and says, okay, it's all set. And he says, you owe me $100. Mm-hmm. He goes, hey, you hit the furnace with a hammer. He said, I want an itemized bill. And he said, and the bill says, hit furnace with a hammer, $1. Knowing where to hit it, $99.
So, and travel time.
Yeah. So again, it's sort of knowing where to hit and what to hit can make all the difference in the world.
Talent and expertise.
It is. It is. So,
what's up?
Well, my computer's still updating. It's up to about 2 hours now.
It should have like this voice that comes recalculating.
Yeah, it should. It's this is the one thing about computerized.
Well, you didn't update it since like 1997.
No, I thought it was just recent. But the one interesting thing about this is what concerns me about autonomous cars that are going to be hugely computer. I mean, right now there's more computer technology in a car than there probably is in a 747.
Right.
But the idea that your car is going to run on a computer like this, and what happens when it goes to update?
Update.
Yeah, updating. And you're like, well, I'll just pull over.
Well, excuse me, boss, I'd be in, but my car is updating right now.
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
Just a new excuse.
So the piano guy's playing, which means which means that you're here.
I am.
Yeah. So what's up for the Irish Hit Parade today, Sully?
Lots and lots of great Irish music. Well, we try.
Yeah. The very best in Irish music heard every weekend right here on AM 950 WROL. Until next weekend, make sure you wear your seatbelt, drive safely, be good to your car. Talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.